The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Good morning and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, coming to you today live from the beautiful campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College here in Edmond, Oklahoma, before even the sun comes up. Greeting to those who are streaming around the world at kpcg.fm, or for those who are listening to the podcast version of this show. I'm not Stephen Flurry, I'm Brent Nuchtigal. He's traveling back, or traveled back yesterday, to the United Kingdom with his family. So I'll be filling in today. I hope you don't mind. Today we've got a full show in the second half of the program. I'm going to be talking about the recent vote, or two votes, by UNESCO attempting to erase the Jewish connection to Jerusalem. And we'll look at some archaeological discoveries in light of that claim that came out the very same day that they had that vote. But for the first half of the show, I want to follow up on something that I spoke about almost 2 weeks ago, specifically relating to Iran's movements in Yemen. This came at the time that the Houthis, the Iranian-backed militia group, terrorist group, in Yemen, fired a couple of missiles, anti-ship missiles, against the United States there inside the Red Sea. And the hoopla that surrounded that and the follow-up of after those attacks, that's what we discussed. And after that time, we've had some astute observers in this world write pieces, even one as late as yesterday, which we'll quote, that recognize the situation that now exists in Yemen as far as sea traffic passing through the Red Sea there, that important passageway where trade reaches from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea. And some people looking at it thinking that we're in a more precarious situation than we originally thought. Yes, we thought the Houthis were a ragtag bunch, a militia that wouldn't be able to take over Yemen, and yet they're doing that. Yes, we thought the Houthis were charging around with AK-47s and didn't have the materiel, sophisticated weaponry, enough to put at risk shipping through the Bab al-Mandab Strait off the coast of Yemen, and yet people are realizing that we were wrong with that. And the first article I want to talk about in relation to that is one written in Foreign Policy magazine. This is obviously a very credible source. It's an article entitled, "Is the U.S. Navy a Sitting Duck?" Now, when we talk about Yemen, I do want to remind our listeners that we've been talking about Yemen for 5 years and how there is a huge danger as far as any type of seaborne traffic that passes through those straits, because it's only an 18-mile gap there between Africa and the Arabian Peninsula, and Yemen sits as the gatekeeper of that. And we back 5 years ago, based not on anything really we could see in the world at the time, but Bible prophecy, Gerald Flurry, the Trumpet editor-in-chief, came out and described how that Iran is going to move to try and dominate those sea lanes, including the countries that are aligned or alongside that sea lane of the Red Sea and Southern Mediterranean. And that was, again, we've seen that happen over the past 5 years. And then even back in 2015, when the Houthis started to take over Yemen, we drew your attention to the fact that this was an Iranian proxy, and that Iran was mobilizing the Houthis for the very purpose of not taking over Yemen for taking over Yemen's sake, but so that it could further its regional ambition of dominating the sea lane here off the coast of Yemen. And we wrote this 5 years ago, and now events are catching up with that forecast. This is the article written by James Holmes in Foreign Policy, October 25th, 2016. He writes, more from the angle of whether the United States in the future will pull out of policing the Red Sea, as they've done for so long, and what could lead to that event. He writes, outclassed adversaries have a pesky habit of refusing to admit they're outclassed. To wit, earlier this month, U.S. Navy destroyers cruising off the Yemeni coast exchanged fire with Houthi rebels armed with C-802 anti-ship missiles. The C-802 is a ubiquitous missile of Chinese origin. Among the countries fielding these missiles is Iran, the Houthis' patron and likely supplier of anti-ship weaponry. And we're going to see a little bit later possibly where or the route in which these weapons took from Iran, which fulfills another prophecy, which we'll get to later on. But he continues here, writing for Foreign Policy. The two C-802s lanced out over the Gulf of Aden on Sunday, October 9, prompting the crew of USS Mason to launch two SM-2 anti-air missiles, an evolved Sea Sparrow missile, and a Nauka radar decoy in self-defense. I don't really know what those things are, but they sound very expensive, as we'll get to. The Houthis' missiles, he continues, fell harmlessly into the sea. Then, on October 12th, the Houthi gunners struck again, firing two more anti-ship missiles, which prompted the Mason to deploy defensive countermeasures once again. That day happened to be the anniversary of the October 2000 small boat attack on the destroyer USS Cole. You might remember that. Who was moored in the Gulf of Aden at the time. Aden, again, is a harbor in, you guessed it, Yemen. The timing can be no accident. If the Houthis want to send a message to the Americans, how better to remind them of the last time a non-state Yemeni combatant scored a heavy hit against the U.S. Navy? So they fired the second attack, the Houthis did, the very anniversary of the attack of the USS Cole back in 2000. The article continues, the offensive U.S. reply came swiftly. The next day, the USS Nitz Mason sister ship peppered three Houthi radar sites with Tomahawk land attack cruise missiles, partially blinding the militants' anti-ship capability. Why does this matter, he asks. For one thing, this was no idle tit-for-tat between the United States Navy and an Iranian surrogate. Such skirmishes have consequences. I mean, this isn't just a little bit of fire in the middle of a non-consequential area. These skirmishes have consequences. He continues, Yemen adjoins the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, the juncture between the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. If a coastal foe can menace shipping transiting this seaway, this narrow seaway, it would disrupt the shortest, most convenient sea route connecting Europe with South and East Asia. Doing so would carry significant economic and military repercussions. That's very interesting. That's what we've been saying is going to happen. That is going to happen. Iran is going to dominate that sea lane. And they are going to, if not cut off traffic through there, make it very expensive for any type of cargo to travel through that area, because of the higher risk that that cargo now faces, because it can be attacked from the land. He continues, now it's doubtful the Houthis could close the strait altogether. Well, we'll see about that. Foreign navies that are on station nearby for counter-piracy duties and would likely frustrate such an attempt. That's possible. Then he says, nevertheless, Houthi antics could drive insurance rates sky high for merchant shipping, prompting shippers to bypass the danger zone, detouring all the way around the Cape of Good Hope at Africa's southernmost tip because it could become the cheaper option, notwithstanding all the fuel wear and tear and the time such protracted voyages involve. In a sense, then, the Houthis could conscript insurance firm Lloyd's of London as an ally, magnifying their influence while distorting patterns of trade and military operations. So he's saying that they could make it very expensive to any ship trying to pass through there because insurance rates are going to go sky high, because those ships are in danger of being attacked and destroyed. Then he writes, but the exchange of fire between the U.S. and the Houthis also helps us glimpse the future of sea combat. It confirms an adage from a good old book, there is nothing new under the sun. Of course, that's a quote from Ecclesiastes in the Bible. I don't know if this author realizes that. There's much more that the Bible says about this specific action in the Red Sea right now as well. But he says, few can match the United States arsenal. Of course, that's true. We've talked about that at length. how powerful the U.S. Navy is, even on this program and other programs on KPCG. Then he writes, weaker combatants grasp that asymmetry and refuse to fight America's fight or submit meekly to its demands. They hunt for tactics and hardware that can outflank U.S. material supremacy. And then he talks about this is a time-honored strategic logic. Combatants have different comparative strengths and frailties. They try to nullify their antagonist's strengths while exploiting their weaknesses for strategic gain. It's as simple as that. You'd do the same thing as the Houthis would in their place, he writes. And then he says, and here's another historical truth. Lesser fighters can prevail despite their material inferiority. Now, it is important to notice that. I mean, we're not just saying that the United States, you know, is going to would be defeated by the Houthis if there was an all-out attack between the both or an all-out battle. Obviously, that wouldn't be the case. But what he's saying here is the Houthis don't have to and they wouldn't attack the United States in that way to get them out of this Red Sea passage. That would do exactly what they're doing right now. He continues, and under what circumstances could combatants like the Houthis succeed by pelting Western vessels with missiles? Well, the stronger Navy usually wins today as more powerful forces have across the centuries. But the strong can take a serious bruising along the way. Even woefully outmatched antagonists like the Houthis can exact a heavy price for victory. Then he makes this comment. Make the price prohibitive, and the strong may refuse to pay. A half-hearted opponent may go away, leaving weak yet strong-willed defenders holding contested real estate or whatever's at issue in the competition. So he's saying just make the cost large enough for the United States and they might leave. That's all the Houthis need to do. Well, that's all Iran needs to do. Make the cost large enough that America can no longer stomach being there, and they'll leave. Now, then he goes into some math here, and basically he looks at how much it costs for the Houthis to fire the weaponry that they did. The Houthis firing the C-802 anti-ship missile, which are about $500,000 a piece, which the $500,000 a piece. How did this ragtag bunch get $500,000 weapons to fire at the United States? You could ask that question. But to retaliate for each one of those attacks, for the countermeasures, cost America $8 million. And that's eight times what the Houthis cost, at least for that when they fired those two missiles and the U.S. Navy tried to ward off that attack. That's 8-1. Is it affordable? He says, sure, it's affordable. If the Navy leadership and the U.S. political leadership are prepared to bear the expense of putting ships in harm's way. Now, that's a good question. How much more could the United States take? They could afford it. Well, you know, if you counter in the U.S. debt, they probably can't afford it. But they have enough money to, you know, fire, you know, these missiles back at a ratio of 8-1 as far as the costs that they incur, as opposed to the Houthis. But how long could that go on for? He writes this. He continues here. Political leaders could come to question whether the strategic gains of staging a naval presence off Yemen's coast justify the expense and hazard of doing so. If the Obama administration or its successor decided the reward isn't worth the cost and risk, it may pull the naval squadron back out of harm's way. But by retreating over the horizon, Washington may surrender that portion of the Gulf of Aden to Houthi militants, letting them claim victory, and the weak would have won. Now, that's interesting here. You've got the Foreign Policy magazine here discussing the cost benefit whereby the United States would actually retreat from the Gulf of Aden and Red Sea area because of a few anti-ship missiles that the Houthis fire on their ships. They could decide it's not worth it, depending on the Obama administration or even the administration following could say it's not worth it. Then he talked a little bit about how effective the countermeasures were and how it was a show of military might, so rare in the times that we live in. But then he says, let's not get cocky. This was a pricey victory. Future victories promised to be just as pricey, raising the cost of defending oceanic thoroughfares. Political leaders should put the case to the American people that this is a price worth their taxpayer dollars. And no doubt they should, if they're going to spend U.S. taxpayer dollars on counter-Houthi measures or even stationing the Navy there, they should have a good argument for doing so. But what it's saying there also is that if the American public doesn't want that, if the American public doesn't have the foresight to see why the United States for the past half century has ensured that any sea traffic could pass through here, these straits, if they don't see the value of that, then the United States taxpayer may say, well, let's get out of there. What are we even doing there? Now, this is interesting because we've seen this happen before. I mean, this is Iran's tactic. If you look at what happened in Iraq on land now, of course, the Iraq incursion in the early 2000s, Americans' troops were stationed there for a long time. It didn't look to be going well. Then we had the troop surge from 2006 through 2008. And things were looking very good in Iraq. The death, there weren't, you know, it wasn't Americans being killed at an alarming rate as it was previously. Things were stabilizing in Iraq. And then President Obama comes into power, and one of his main platforms is, I'm going to bring our boys home from Iraq. We're going to pull out. I have determined that the cost of keeping those soldiers there is not worth it. Iran had done enough. Is Iran going to defeat the U.S. military pound for pound in open battle? No. But can they inflict enough pain for long enough so that the American public no longer has the stomach for it? Or because to make the American politicians then no longer have the stomach for it. And if they do that, America will pull out. And that's what we've seen in Iraq. 2009, the surge ends. President Obama starts to pull out the American forces out of Iraq. We have the rise of ISIS in that vacuum. And then we have, especially over the past few years, as we said back when the United States went into Iraq, that this was going to end up with Iraq being one of Iran's surrogates, Iran taking over Iraq. And what we've seen over the past couple of years is Iranian-backed Shiite militias taking over southern Iraq, really hamstringing the Baghdad government to the point now where the Baghdad government is so weak and ineffectual that they answer to Iran as well. Iran didn't have to fight the U.S. an all-out war in an open battle. All they had to do was inflict enough pain that they would retreat. And what do we see? Iran taking over Iraq. And they're doing the same thing now over water. They're doing the same thing in the Red Sea via the Houthis. Inflict enough pain, and the American public and politicians thereafter will no longer have the stomach for it, and they will pull out. There's one more story I just want to talk about before the break that continues this same thought about how Iran is trying to dominate the sea lanes all the way around the Persian Gulf. We've talked about them, how they are trying to influence events in Bahrain, in the western part of the Persian Gulf, and then obviously the Straits of Hormuz are very important. That I think it's about a 22-mile gap between southern Iran and Oman in the Persian Gulf. 30% of world seaborne oil passes through that strait, and then it comes out into the Indian Ocean, goes round Oman, past Yemen, and back up the Red Sea. And we wrote a story back in May 2016 at thetrumpet.com, will Oman become beholden to Iran? Now, Oman is a small country, a few million people, doesn't get much attention. But it did at the time, back in May, when the details of the nuclear deal were finally becoming exposed before the world, and it looked like that because of the nuclear deal, you had, well, the early processes of that deal, it was Oman as acted as the mediator between the United States and Iran. And they do this often, actually. Oman is considered probably the most centrist power in the Middle East as far as being trying to maintain friendship with everybody. And that's one of the reasons why the United States used them in this regard to try and start this process back in as early as 2009, but this rapprochement between America and the United States. And we wrote an article, America and Iran, we wrote an article back in May talking about how that Iran, because of a lot of the relaxation of sanctions that were going to come down in the post-nuclear world, that Oman was going to benefit financially from the nuclear deal as well. And while they weren't necessarily pro-Iran, this was going to benefit them. And it's interesting, as soon as the nuclear deal went through, Iran actually came out and praised their friend Oman for helping out in this process because they were able to remove those sanctions that were just so devastating on their economy. But what did Iran, obviously they wanted to let down those sanctions, but they had a plan for Oman as well. Now, I wrote this article back in May because Oman sits at the southern entrance, the southern gateway of the Straits of Hormuz. Iran is at the northern tip. And yet all navigable, the sea lanes, basically where ships pass, come through Oman's territorial waters. So looking at that same prophecy discussed in Daniel chapter 11, which talks about Iran, this king of the south that was going to ensure that they controlled this waterway, we made the forecast that Oman was going to become beholden to Iran so that Iran continues its power over those sea lanes. And it's interesting, there were a couple of comments to that article. And I just want to read a couple of comments from a few people. They said this. This was from Jamshid. Sounds like somebody from the region. He says, "The tone of this article is biased against Iran and not in favor of Oman, but seemingly Saudi Arabia. It is in Iran's and Oman's best interest to be friends and work together, as it is in the best interests of all nations." Now, that might be true. It might be in Oman's best interest to work together with Iran if Iran didn't have ulterior motives. Iran does not care about Oman. And that was the point of this article. Yes, there will be a temporary alliance, but it's for what Iran can get. And it has everything to do about the control of the sea lane. Jamshid concluded saying, "Good luck with your sowing of the seeds of discord." Then Tom Khan said this, "Wow. I did not know that this site was also," this is of course an article on thetrumpet.com, "that this site was also bought out by the Saudis. I was laughing the whole time while reading this. No, Iran does not have a wish to create an empire. No, Iran does not have terrorists in other countries. No, Iran does not bully its allies. In fact, this whole article seems to lead to Saudi Arabia, a pro-terrorist fake kingdom, nation that pays terrorists to suicide bomb themselves in public. It bribes and bullies its neighbors and has done everything it can to create chaos in the region for its own personal gain. Oman is an independent country that can make its decisions for itself. This article is a joke." And that was back in May, those comments. Now look what was reported just this past week. This article is entitled "Exclusive." It's from Reuters. "Iran steps up weapons supply to Yemen's Houthis via," where? Oman. So yeah, that didn't look like, you know, there was much collusion militarily at all between Oman and Iran, but Oman forms the land bridge before you get to Yemen, And the United States and other navies increased their patrols around the Gulf of Aden down through the Red Sea because they knew that Iran was sending shipments of weapons, sea containers full of weapons, to the Houthis. So what did Iran do? Well, Iran tapped their newfound friend, Oman, and said, hey, you turn a blind eye, at the very least, to what we want to do. We're going to send weapons now across the land, 30 miles across the Straits of Hormuz. They've been smuggling stuff into Oman for years. It's very simple for them to do. And then when it gets there, we're going to go across land with our weaponry to arm the Houthis. Now, let's just ask the question now, with that in mind, is Oman becoming beholden to Iran? Does Oman want this? We don't know. Maybe, probably not. Probably not. They seem to be a peaceful people in Oman. And the leadership there is very stable. It has been an American ally for a long time. Yet, we said they were going to become beholden to Iran. And they are. They are the transit route now for weaponry that is going through to the Houthis. I'm not going to read this article, but it's from Reuters. It quotes a lot of sources in the know. It says even that some of the weaponry was likely anti-ship cruise missiles, the very same type that were fired against the American vessels. This is the post-nuclear deal world. Opened up Oman further to Iran, and now the Iranians are using Oman to get their weaponry to the Houthis. No wonder Saudi Arabia is upset. Now, we're not pro-Saudi Arabia, pro-Iran, pro any of those nations necessarily, but we're trying to be fair here. Now, the Saudi Arabia's support of terrorism, sure, that's longstanding and known. But Iran also has a game plan. And the Bible indicates that it's not Saudi Arabia that's the king of the south. It is Iran that has ambition greater than its own territory. And that's why it's gobbling up or creating allies or gobbling up territory all the way across the Middle East. Now, you know, straight underneath Saudi Arabia, it's moving huge weapons through Oman to get into Yemen. And this is something, again, that Bible prophecy indicated was going to happen. Yes, Oman is becoming beholden to Iran. They're turning this blind eye to that weaponry. Now, if you want to understand this more, you need to get our book. It's entitled The King of the South. It's been updated recently. The original version was written back in the early 1990s when we said that Iran did have these ambitions and that was going to move to take over the Middle East. And then in the past 20-plus years, bits have been added to that to show just how they've done that and to show how specifically they have a strategy that does include Oman, does include Yemen, and does include all the nations that are along that Red Sea passageway. Get out a map, have a look at this, and understand what Iran's up to. This isn't just a back-and-forth tit-for-tat skirmish. Iran has global ambitions. It's up to you. It can be clear to you. Request that booklet, The King of the South. You've been listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll be discussing the latest UN attack on Israel. And this time, it is this attack to try and erase any Jewish connection to to Jerusalem's holy sites. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The King of the South is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the Literature tab to select your free booklet.
The Trumpet Daily.
I love Israel and honor and respect the Jewish faith and tradition. And it's important that we have a president who feels the same way. For me, respect and reverence for Judaism is personal. My daughter Ivanka and my son-in-law Jared are raising their children in the Jewish faith, always reminding me the important values and lessons we learn about leadership, resolve, and families in Jewish tradition. My administration will stand side by side with the Jewish people and Israel's leaders to continue strengthening the bridges that connect not only Jewish Americans and Israelis, but also all Americans and Israelis. Together, we will stand up to the enemies like Iran, bent on destroying Israel and her people. Together, we will make America and Israel safe again.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I'm Brent Nuchtigal filling in for Stephen Fleury, and you were just listening to Donald Trump. He sent that message to Israel yesterday. There were several hundred Israeli supporters gathered in Jerusalem for an event that was sponsored by Republicans overseas, and it was titled Jerusalem Forever. It was given by Mr. Trump in light of the recent UNESCO resolutions that have tried to delegitimize Israel's claim to Jerusalem's holy sites. Now, both candidates at this time are pushing hard for the Jewish vote. There are obviously a lot of Jews still in America, and they're trying hard to reach those people and prove that they are the stronger candidate for Israel. Yet it is interesting that we talked about this even a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago in this program, and shows how that in the future, Bible prophecy indicates, regardless of the candidate that gets in power, the relationship between Israel and the United States is on the way out. And it's not going to have a small improvement, but probably not after President Obama leaves. It is going to continue to deteriorate. Yet what I want to talk about is not necessarily America's response to the UNESCO decision, but the UNESCO decision itself and how it might play into the future of Jerusalem's history and Jerusalem archaeology. Now, again, his comments were prompted by this resolution, the second one in a couple of weeks, that was passed by UNESCO. And I'll just discuss that now from an article from the Times of Israel by Rafael Aran. He writes, an important panel at the United Nations Educational, Cultural, and Scientific Organization. That's the name of this group. I'm going to read that again. The United Nations Educational, Cultural, and Scientific Organization, or UNESCO, on Wednesday morning approved a controversial resolution that ignores Jewish and Christian ties to the Temple Mount and the surrounding area. The decision came a week after a similar resolution was approved by the body and elicited angry responses from Israel and several world leaders. Convening in its annual meeting in Paris, UNESCO's World Heritage Committee adopted draft resolution 40.7a-13, entitled Old City of Jerusalem and Its Walls, by a large majority, with 10 countries voting in favor, 8 abstaining, and 2 opposing the text. 8 yes votes were needed for the resolution to pass, and it passed. And again, it no longer calls the Temple Mount. It talks about how Jews are trying to destroy Muslim sites on and around the Temple Mount, and decries, or doesn't even mention any Christian or Jewish claim to that land around the Temple Mount, which is a little absurd, as we'll talk about. Yet it passed, and this is the premier body, remember, for the world, the UN, obviously, but UNESCO decides upon world heritage areas or not, and it has strong power over governments to accept their recommendations. And here we have the governing body of UNESCO voting and not acknowledging Jewish claims, Israeli claims to the Temple Mount and the surrounding areas. Now, this is what Israel's ambassador to UNESCO had to say just after the vote.
I give the floor to the representative of Israel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have just adopted yet another absurd resolution against the State of Israel, against the Jewish people, against historical truths, and one which stands in complete and utter contradiction to all values which this disintegrating organization is supposed to stand for. All this at a time when forces of radical Islam are destroying the history and legacy of many nations, demolishing mosques and churches, and not even sparing archaeological sites. All this at a time when the State of Israel is the only nation in the region which upholds these values, protects these places, while allowing freedom of worship equally to all religions. If it were not so said, we would find it funny that an international organization established for the purpose of documentation and preservation of history and heritage is extorted into being used as a tool to rewrite the annals of history. The battle for Jerusalem did not start with the last vote, nor would it end with today's. Israel is sovereign in Jerusalem and shall continue to exercise its sovereignty there, while Palestinians and other Arab nations continue to toy with imaginary and absurd resolutions, which put to shame those who place them on the agenda, as well as those who raise their hands in favor. Jerusalem's futures will be determined by the one and only historical truth, one which we will stand by with deep determination, willing to pay any price. The fate of this resolution shall be no different than that of UN Resolution 3379, adopted in 1975, which equated Zionism with racism. That absurd resolution was cancelled 16 years later, but the moral stain still remains on all those who adopted. It might take years in our case as well, until the Jerusalem resolutions are eradicated from the annals of this organization. In 1975, it was Israel's ambassador to the UN, the late Chaim Herzog, who tore the paper of the resolution to shreds on stage in front of the entire world. I have no intention of doing it in front of you today, not because of your dignity, nor because of the dignity of this organization, but simply because this resolution paper is not even worth the energy needed for tearing it to shreds. It will be much simpler and a lot more appropriate to place it in its rightful place, the garbage place of history. And this is the garbage, Madam Chairman, and this is the resolution, and this is the place for it.
So you heard it there. The Israeli ambassador to UNESCO picked up a trash bin with the name History written on it, with a label History written on it, grabbed the resolution and threw it in the bin. And so he should. So he should. It's absolutely ridiculous. And we'll talk about just a couple of stories here that came out the very same day that this resolution was passed at UNESCO, that again was trying to delegitimize Israel's historical connection to the Temple Mount, as laughable as that seems. The people voted for it and it passed. And again, people love the UN, or have done in the past at least. And this is the group that is in charge of ensuring that historical sites are preserved, and they're denying Israel's connection to that land surrounding the Temple Mount, the Old City of Jerusalem. This is an article from Haaretz from Wednesday as well. It's entitled, Israel Displays First Temple-Era Pottery Fragments Found on Temple Mount. It writes, discoveries found in situ, or in the location which they were found, on the Temple Mount dating to the late First Temple period, excavated and collected by the Israeli Antiquities Authority over the last 10 years, were on display by the agency in Jerusalem on Wednesday. So what they did, obviously, this is probably planned. Israel knew that this resolution was going to come forward to the UNESCO for a vote. So they decided to put some proof on display that, yes, there is some Jewish historic connection to this land. When it says the First Temple period, it's not saying that these vessels were obviously from the temple necessarily. It's just saying that they were in use during the time that the First Temple existed. The First Temple is just another name for the Temple of Solomon that was constructed, started being constructed around 970 or 967 BC, was constructed for 7 years and stayed in use all the way through till the destruction of the Kingdom of Judea in 586-585 BC. So that's what the first temple period is between Solomon and Zedekiah, the period of the Old Testament after King David. And they have found artifacts on the Temple Mount, in fact, right near the Dome of the Rock, that testify to people being there. And these vessels, the type of them, are distinctly Jewish. So they decided to show them. And then this article talks about the real damage that was done to these holy sites and when it was done. It writes, "But the breaking point in respect to damaging antiquities on the Temple Mount was in 1999 when the Waqf, the Muslim religious trust that administers the site..." People don't understand this, but even though, you know, Israel won the Six-Day War in 1967, and they controlled all the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, including all of the Old City, and had right to control the Temple Mount as well, which had, yes, for the previous few hundred years, been a Islamic site predominantly, because we're in the middle of the Middle East, and that's where... different Arabs constructed the Dome of the Rock Shrine, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, from 700 to 1000 AD. Yes, it has been a Muslim holy site. Well, the Waqf, actually, when Israel took over the Temple Mount, they allowed the Jordanians to still maintain control of this area of the Temple Mount. Even though Jordan's, you know, borders pushed back to the other side of the Jordan River, to the other side of the Dead Sea, "We will allow you guys to maintain your religious observance here, and will even not direct daily affairs over the Temple Mount. We'll allow the Jordanians to do that." Of course, if there's violence up there, yes, Israeli forces will intervene. But other than that, they don't really intervene. So Israeli archaeologists were kind of upset by this, obviously, in 1967, because they'd seen what... many Arabs do to other religions, or what Muslims do many times, not in all cases, but many times to other religious artifacts from other peoples. They destroy them. And it also would ensure that none of the Temple Mount could be opened up for archaeology as well. So how does the Israeli Antiquities Authority then display artifacts from the first temple period that were excavated from the Temple Mount? How do they do that on Wednesday if it's impossible to dig there? Well, there have been a few digs there, and they were not archaeological digs by any means. They were construction projects overseen by the Waqf to expand the huge mosques that are already quite large there. And you might have seen photos of this back in 1999, huge bulldozers and front-end loaders and excavators working on the Temple Mount, the southwestern wall of it, and the inside of it, right to the east of Al-Aqsa Mosque, the one with the black dome. And they were just, I mean, this was an earth-moving site. There was no archaeology that was done here. They were just removing the dirt with a bulldozer, putting it in dump trucks, and then dumping it in the adjacent Kidron Valley. So, yes, you could say it's been excavated, the Temple Mount, but it wasn't excavated systematically. A lot of it was done under the cover of night because antiquity was being destroyed here on the Temple Mount. I'm talking meters and meters and meters down, 20 meters down of earth that would be probably the most prized earth on the planet for archaeological value. Of course, when you take something in archaeology, if you just rip it out of the ground, whatever's there, obviously you're going to destroy it if there's any structures, but you're also going to destroy the context in which artifacts would have been discovered. And if you don't have context, or you don't have the date of the surrounding material, then you don't really know if it was found in situ, in the location at which it was left when it broke. But what happened? Well, some Israeli archaeologists, they located where all this was being dumped, and they decided that we are going to sift through all of that material. We are going to go in the Kidron Valley, collect it. Yes, it's not in context, but it came from the Temple Mount. So we're going to sift through it. For the past decade, they've been sifting through that. And they've found, what have they found? It's a good question. Have they found just Muslim Islamic artifacts? Or did they find Jewish artifacts or Israeli artifacts from all periods of history? Well, you can research that. It's the Temple Mount Sifting Project. You can go online. They have a website. And you'll see how they record and have photos of a lot of Jewish artifacts. So yes, there was excavation on the Temple Mount, but it was done in a hasty manner, and it was done by the Arabs themselves, and they dumped it all in the Kidron Valley. This other article that came out the very same day as this UNESCO approval that denied Jewish and failed to mention any Jewish history in relation, Jewish ties relation to the Temple Mount. There was another discovery that was made and that was presented to the public on Wednesday. This is from the Jerusalem Post from yesterday. It says here, on the same day the UNESCO approved a resolution ignoring Jewish ties to the Temple Mount, the Israeli Antiquities Authority on Wednesday displayed an unprecedented document containing a reference to Jerusalem from the First Temple period. This actually says Jerusalem on it. From the 7th century, not AD, the 7th century AD, that would still predate the earliest, that would still predate, would be around the same time as Muhammad, if it was in AD. But we're going to go back 1,400 years and look at a document that says Jerusalem on it. Written in ancient Hebrew script and dating back to the kingdom of Judah during the 7th century BC, the rare relic made of papyrus is the earliest extra-biblical source to mention Jerusalem in Hebrew writing. That's right, Hebrew writing. Hebrew writing. The writing of the Jews. And it says Jerusalem. And it was found just on the outskirts of Jerusalem. Plundered from one of the Judean caves by a band of antiquities robbers, the document was seized in a complex operation by the Israeli Antiquities Authority Unit for the Prevention and Antiquities Robbery. Now, I just think that's what the UNESCO should be worried about, and trying to exert some of its energy to stopping these illegal excavations by bandits that are just trying to find items of rare historical significance so they could be sold on the black market. That's what I think UNESCO would be good to have resolutions against, and use some of its millions of dollars in funding to try and stop. Back to this article, according to IAA Director Israel Hassan, two lines of ancient Hebrew were preserved on the document made from the pith of the papyrus plant. Now, this is interesting. Just a week ago, somebody was asking me if they'd found papyrus from this early of a time, 7th century, or First Temple period. And I was like, I can't really recall. And it's probably going to be broken down. The Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, they are written on papyrus, but they're from 700 years later than this, what was found recently. But it was found in a very dry location along the Dead Sea, so it was preserved. Paper from however long ago, that 2,700 years ago. A paleographic examination of the letters, this is the article continues, and a C14 analysis determined, that's carbon dating, analysis determined that the artifact should be dated to the 7th century BCE, to the end of the First Temple period. Most of the letters are clearly legible, and the proposed reading of the text is as follows, and I'll just read it in English. From the king's maidservant from Na'arat, which is a town on the outskirts of Jerusalem, jars of wine to Jerusalem. To Jerusalem, it actually says Yerushalayim on it in ancient Hebrew. Hebrew, Jewish, history attached to Jerusalem, UNESCO. Then it continues, it was subsequently determined that the antiquity, or the artifact, is an original shipping document from the time of the First Temple period, indicating the payment of taxes or transfer of goods to storehouses in Jerusalem. Really just very, very interesting discovery. The same day again as this vote. This is at the end of the article. It says, denouncing UNESCO's vote, Minister of Culture and Sport, M.K. Miri Regev, said the relic further proves the inexorable historical connection between the Jews and Jerusalem. Yes, it does. Quote, the discovery of the papyrus on which the name of our capital, Jerusalem, is written is further tangible evidence that Jerusalem was and will remain the eternal capital of the Jewish people. It is our duty to take care of the plundering of antiquities that occurs in the Judean desert, and no less important than this is exposing the deceit of false propaganda, as is once again happening today in UNESCO. And that's true. And that's true. It needs to be exposed for the lies that it is. And I even talked to some Israelis the other, 3 weeks ago. I was playing basketball here with some acquaintances there in Israel. And even some of them were like, well, can we really believe that's what our government's saying? Yes, actually, you can. You can. It's tangible. You can pick it up and you can read it. It is dateable. They did it. It's not a forgery. It's not. I mean, I've had people argue with me with artifacts I saw come directly out of the ground myself that, you know, ancient Hebrew written on them from the First Temple period. Notice how one of these stories ends, actually. This is the Times of Israel piece. And this, I think, is what's worrying about UNESCO's decision. We could blow it off and say it's not important. But this is what it says. The adoption of the resolution creates an absurd situation whereby the archaeological digs on and around the site of the Temple Mount, which have unearthed copious evidence of Jewish connection to the site, may now be designated as destruction of the Muslim site. From now on, according to UNESCO, the world body for preserving these sites, if you do a dig on and around the Temple Mount now, you might be accused of destroying a Muslim site. Why is that? Well, I mean, destruction happens in archaeology. It's a destructive science. Cities are built one on top of the other. And you have to go through layers and layers and layers and layers to get to earlier occupation. So when it comes to Jerusalem, yes, a lot of the time you do have to destroy Islamic sites in the sense of you need to go underneath them because they're so recent. They're so recent in the history of Jerusalem that they're close to the top. So you're doing a dig down in just to the southern wall of the Temple Mount like we have for years. And like even going back to 1968, the end of the Six-Day War, excavation started there immediately. And dig through layers. And yes, you're going to start at the Muslim periods. But it's well documented. You take pictures of it. You draw up reconstructions of it. You treat it like you would the other periods. But you need to go underneath them. You need to go underneath them because you need to find earlier history. And what do we find underneath the Islamic periods? Just below the Temple Mount wall? Well, you find Crusader period. Christians were there. Before that, you'll find the Byzantine period going all the way back to 4th century AD. Christians were there before Islam was a thing, before it was an Islamic holy site. Go under that, you're going to get to the Roman period. And then Herodian period, when Jews were there, the time of Jesus Christ. To get rid of that, you'll get to the Hellenistic period. Who was there in Jerusalem? Jews, again. And then get rid of that, and you'll go underneath that, you'll get to the Persian period with the, you know, Nehemiah, Zerubbabel, those leaders. Who was there? Jewish. Underneath that, you'll get to the First Temple period. And is the First Temple period in Jerusalem Jewish? You betcha. You betcha it is. But it's interesting in here. Now, UNESCO might come out and start condemning digs in and around the old city of Jerusalem, because you have to damage Islamic sites, or let's just say in a house from an Islamic period, to actually find them, because they're so much earlier. They were there thousands of years before the Islamic sites were actually there. So this UNESCO decision, we'll see if it has greater import moving forward. But it's interesting. I mean, the UN, UNESCO, it's always attacking the Jews. It's always attacking Israel, and now it's attacking Jewish history in Jerusalem, of all places. This is the foremost body for the protection of heritage and culture around the world, and it attacks the Jews, the ones that are trying to uphold the history of Jerusalem for all periods. Now, why is this the case? Why single out the Jews? Now, there's a book that explains that. It has a lot to do with archaeology in Jerusalem as well. And it explains why the Jews have been singled out through all history and why they've been targeted so often, not just in relation to the Palestinian issue or in archaeology, but throughout history, time and time again. That book that you can request at thetrumpet.com is entitled The Key of David. The Key of David. It's available for request again at thetrumpet.com. That brings us to the end of this Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on KPCG on 101.3 FM here in Edmond, Oklahoma, and online at kpcg.fm. You can send your feedback to td@kpcg.fm. I'm sure Stephen Fleury will appreciate that, and he will be with you tomorrow. I'll see you next time.